3, expand it. Notice other elements of the experience. For example, if you're having a useful thought, look for related sensations or emotions. 4, freshen it. The brain is a novelty detector, designed to learn from what's new or unexpected. So look for what's interesting or surprising about an experience. Imagine that you are having it for the very first time. 5, value it. We learn from what is personally relevant. Be aware of why the experience is important to you, why it matters, and how it could help you. Any one of these methods will increase the impact of an experience, and the more, the better. But you don't have to use all of them every time. Often, you'll simply stay with something for a little while and feel it in your body, and then move on to the next experience. Absorbing an experience. You can increase the absorption of an experience in 3 ways. 1, intend to receive it. Consciously choose to take in the experience. 2, sense it sinking into you. You could imagine that the experience is like a warm, soothing balm or a jewel being placed in the treasure chest of your heart. Give over to it, allowing it to become a part of you. 3, reward yourself. Tune into whatever is pleasurable, reassuring, helpful, or hopeful about the experience. Doing this will tend to increase the activity of 2 neurotransmitter systems, dopamine and norepinephrine, that will flag the experience as a keeper for long-term storage. The first 3 steps of HEAL, have a beneficial experience, enrich it, absorb it, are the essence of learning. To use the metaphor of a fire, these steps are like finding or lighting it, protecting and fueling it, and taking its warmth into yourself. You can use them on the fly multiple times a day, 10 seconds here and half a minute there. You could also set aside a few minutes or more to focus on a particular experience, such as the experiential practice we'll do in a moment. This is not about holding on to experiences. The stream of consciousness is constantly changing, so trying to cling to anything in it is both doomed and painful. But you can gently encourage whatever is beneficial to arise and stick around and sink in, even as you are letting go of it. Happiness is like a beautiful wild animal watching from the edge of a forest. If you try to grab it, it will run away. But if you sit by your campfire and add some sticks to it, happiness will come to you and stay. Experiential practice, enriching and absorbing a sense of caring. Bring to mind someone you naturally care about, such as a friend, child, partner, or pet. Help yourself have a sense of warmth, liking, appreciation, compassion, or love. Once you are having an experience of caring, start to enrich it. Lengthen it by disengaging from distractions and coming back to it if your mind wanders. Keep it going, breath after breath. Open to this experience of caring, letting it fill you, becoming more intense. Expand it by exploring different aspects of caring. Thoughts of caring. Sensations. Emotions. Desires. And actions, such as putting a hand on your heart. Bring an attitude of curiosity to help the experience stay fresh and vivid. Consider how the sense of caring could be important for you, relevant, and valuable. Then focus on absorbing it. consciously intend to receive this experience into yourself. Sense these warm feelings spreading inside, becoming a part of you. Look for what feels good about being caring. How it is enjoyable, heart-opening, and rewarding. Sink into caring as it sinks into you. Grow the strengths you need most. My parents were loving, worked long hours, and did the best they could. Still, for multiple reasons, including my own withdrawal, I did not experience a lot of empathy from them. Children need a rich soup of empathy from their parents, but for me it was a thin broth. Also, I was younger than my classmates due to a late birthday and skipping a grade, and this plus my nerdy temperament led to many experiences of being ignored or rejected at school. My needs for safety and satisfaction were handled well enough, but my need for connection was not. Lots of little things add up over time, and when I left for college, it felt like there was a big hole in my heart, an empty, aching place inside. I didn't know what to do about it. I tried being cautious and determined, which helped me feel safe, but did nothing to fill the hole. I had fun and got good grades, addressing the need for satisfaction, but this too left me hollow inside. It was as if I had scurvy, an unmet need for connection, and required vitamin C, but I was taking vitamin A and vitamin B. These were fine in their own right, but not the key nutrient I was missing. Then, midway through my freshman year, everything changed when I began to notice, feel, and take in social supplies, such as a group waving me over to eat with them, or someone being friendly on the way to class. This was what I needed. This was my vitamin C. Bit by bit, day by day, many little experiences gradually filled that hole in my heart. So, what's your vitamin C? Find your key resources. The three basic needs offer a useful framework for identifying your most important inner resources. When you know what these are, you can usually find opportunities each day for experiencing and growing them. Clarify the challenge. As a doctor might ask, where does it hurt? You may be dealing with an external challenge, such as interpersonal conflict, a stressful job, or a health problem. Or you could be facing an internal challenge, such as harsh self-criticism or feeling unwanted. Sometimes there's a 1-2 punch. For example, tension with someone might be stirring up self-criticism inside you. Pick a challenge and then consider the needs at stake in it, in terms of safety, satisfaction, and connection. More than one need could be involved, but often there's one that stands out. Pain, threat, or immobilization, often with feelings of anxiety, anger, or powerlessness, are clues that safety is at risk. Blocks to reaching your goals, failure, loss of property, or a life with little pleasure, perhaps with a sense of disappointment, frustration, or boredom, suggest that satisfaction needs tending. Interpersonal conflict, rejection, loss, or devaluation, often with feelings of loneliness, hurt, resentment, envy, inadequacy, or shame, flag the need for connection. If you tend to push aside a particular need, such as connection, for instance, by blaming yourself when people mistreat you, that's the one to be extra sure you're not overlooking. Identify the resources that could help. A particular need is best met by inner strengths that are matched to it. If your car is running on fumes, gasoline is the solution, not a spare tire. I'm going to give you a list here of major mental resources for the basic needs, and we'll be exploring each one of them in this book. Safety. Resources include being on your own side, determination, grit, sense of agency, feeling protected, clarity about threats, feeling all right right now, calm, relaxation, and peace. For satisfaction, resources include gratitude, gladness, pleasure, accomplishment, clarity about goals, enthusiasm, passion, motivation, aspiration, feeling of enoughness already, and contentment. And for connection needs, resources include compassion for others and oneself, empathy, kindness, self-worth, skillful assertiveness, forgiveness, generosity, and love. If you're chilled and need to warm up, just about any type of jacket will work. In the same way, any of the resources I've named here will usually help with the need to which it is related. Additionally, a challenge is often best approached with a combination of inner strengths. This said, closely matching a specific resource to a specific challenge can be very useful. For example, I was small going through school and often picked last for sports teams. Those old feelings of embarrassment and weakness have been particularly healed by many experiences of capability and toughness high up in the mountains. As you consider a major challenge and the needs at the heart of it, see if any of the resources that I've named stand out. Ask yourself, what, if it were more present in my mind these days, would really help? What inner strengths could help me stay in the responsive mode when I'm dealing with this challenge? If this challenge began in the past, what would have been really helpful to have experienced back then? Deep down, what experience do I still very much long for? The answers to these questions point to a key resource, your vitamin C. Also, remember this. Love is the multivitamin, the universal medicine. Love helps us feel safe, whether as a scared child getting a hug or as an adult walking with a friend through a dark parking lot. Love is deeply satisfying, and love draws us immediately into a sense of connection. If it's hard to identify a key resource for a challenge, no worries. In one form or another, try love. Internalize key resources. Once you've identified a key strength, use the heal steps to have experiences of it that you install in your nervous system. There might already be a sense of this resource in the back of your mind, and then all you have to do is notice it and bring it to the foreground of awareness. Suppose that you're insecure about your performance at work, and you've realized it would help to feel more respected by your colleagues. It's possible that they're actually saying or doing little things that show they recognize and appreciate you. And there is a fleeting sense of this passing through your awareness. If this is happening, you could try to be more mindful of this experience. You could also create experiences of an important inner resource. For example, if you wanted to feel more respected by your coworkers, you could deliberately look for facts that demonstrated this, such as the sense of camaraderie, a tone of approval, or being asked your opinion. You might also take action, such as speaking up and letting yourself shine more in meetings. When you do find facts that are natural opportunities to experience an inner strength, slow down to focus on them and help the recognition of them become a beneficial experience. Once you're having an experience of the resource, shift into the installation phase of learning. To repeat, you can enrich the experience by staying with it, letting it fill your mind, opening to it in your body, exploring what could be fresh or new about it, and recognizing what is relevant or important about it. Also, absorb it into yourself by intending that it become part of you, sensing it sinking in, and finding what is enjoyable about it. Focus on experiences, not conditions. Any chance to feel and to grow a key mental resource is a valuable opportunity. Know what experiences you are looking for, and when you find them, really take them in. It's natural to think about your resources in terms of people, events, or settings outside of you. But then imagine what these conditions would help you feel inside yourself. It's important to care about external conditions in their own right, including for their effects on others. But for our own practical purposes, they're largely means to the ends of the experiences we value. For example, suppose that a person would like to have a romantic partner. Why might someone seek this condition? At least in part, because then there could be experiences of love, self-worth, joy, and other good things. Certainly, we should try to improve the conditions of life for ourselves and others. But these are often slow to change, if at all. On the other hand, when the focus shifts from means to ends, from conditions to experiences, so many possibilities open up. For example, even without having a romantic partner, a person could find other ways to experience some kinds of love, self-worth, and joy. I'm not trying to minimize the value of a romantic partner or any other external condition. But if that condition is out of reach, there could still be ways to experience some aspects of it. And in terms of internalizing resources into the brain, experiences are independent of the conditions that evoke them. Once a song is playing on the inner iPod, it can be recorded, quote-unquote, regardless of what its source was. Among other things, this means you can help yourself to have and internalize parts of key experiences that may have been missing when you were young, even though the conditions of childhood are long behind you. This distinction between conditions and experiences, between means and ends, is very important, and losing sight of it is the cause of much stress and unhappiness. For example, a person could get fixated and driven about attaining a particular condition, such as a new car or a promotion, and then lose sight of the needs that attaining the condition would fulfill, and miss opportunities to experience those needs being met in other ways. Is the car itself important, or is the sense of comfort and safety what's most valuable? Is the promotion itself the crux of the matter, or is it a sense of success and satisfaction? To put it a little differently, people are not unhappy because they don't have a car or a promotion. They're unhappy because they don't feel comfortable, safe, successful, and satisfied. When you know the true ends, the experiences that matter most, then you can look for when they are already occurring or deliberately create them. You may not be able to have every bit of an important experience, such as feeling loved by a wholly nurturing parent as a child, or cherished by a romantic partner today. But you can almost always find aspects of it that you can internalize, such as feeling liked by a friend or appreciated by a coworker. You may not be able to heal a wound entirely or fill up every bit of the hole in your heart. Still, something is better than nothing. And the somethings you take in may eventually help you get the everything you long for. Use flowers to pull weeds. When I started taking in the good in college, sometimes I'd be aware of two things at once, such as feeling appreciated in the front of awareness with a sense of worthlessness off to the side. When this happened, it would feel like the positive material was touching and going into the negative material, gradually filling up empty places inside and soothing old wounds. This is the essence of the link step in the heal process. It may sound exotic, but there are many ordinary examples. You could be worried about something, and talking with a friend is reassuring. Perhaps there's a setback at work, and you remind yourself of times when you were successful. Maybe an acquaintance is snippy, and it hurts. And then your loving grandfather comes to mind, and that's comforting. When you use the first of the three major ways to relate to your mind to simply be with something that's upsetting, this naturally links a disturbing experience with the always inherently undisturbed field of awareness. Using the neuropsychology of learning. Linking is a powerful method. The brain learns through association, and when two things are held in awareness at the same time, they affect each other. The key is to make sure that what's beneficial stays more prominent than what's painful or harmful. Then the positive will purify the negative, rather than the negative contaminating the positive. Because of the negativity bias, stressful experiences over the course of your life have been prioritized for storage in your brain, especially into what's called implicit memory, the residues of lived experience that shape your expectations, ways of relating to others, and background sense of what it feels like to be you. The remnants of the past affect you in the present, and you can use linking to reduce and even replace them. When negative material is reactivated from memory stores, it becomes unstable and open to positive material that's also present in awareness. Then the negative material goes through a neural process of reconsolidation that can incorporate those positive influences. In the garden of the mind, the first three steps of heal plant flowers. In the fourth step, you use flowers to pull weeds. Being skillful with linking. To do linking, a person must be able to hold two things in awareness, keep the positive material more prominent, and not get hijacked by the negative. Practicing mindfulness will increase your capacity to do these things. If you get pulled into the negative, drop it and focus only on the positive. Later on, you can allow the negative to come back alongside the positive in awareness. Most experiences of linking are fairly brief, under half a minute, but you can take longer if you like. Look for positive material that is naturally matched to the negative material, such as the key resources related to particular challenges that we explored previously. For example, experiences of calm are a soothing antidote to anxiety or nervousness. Being included these days helps heal being left out in the past. If the negative material feels young, focus on nonverbal, tactile, gentle, and sweet aspects of the positive material, much as you would offer to a child of that age. There are two ways to enter into linking. You'll often start with something positive, such as the sense of a key resource. While having that experience, you can bring to mind some negative material for which it would be good medicine. The other way is to start with something that is uncomfortable, stressful, or harmful, such as a lot of anxiety before giving a presentation of some kind. In the sequence of let be, let go, let in, after letting your feelings be as long as you like and then letting go of them, you would find positive material to replace what you had released, such as a sense of calm from knowing that people are actually interested in hearing what you have to say. So far, you've used just the first three steps of heal. Then if you want, you could move into the fourth step and bring the positive material into contact with remnants or layers of the negative material in order to uproot it most fully. Be cautious with negative material. If it's too powerful, you can grow mental resources for addressing it through the first three heal steps alone. Then, when you feel ready, you can link it to positive material in three increasingly intense ways. Know it. The least intense and generally safest way to engage negative material is to be aware of just the idea of it, such as the knowledge that you lost a parent when you were a child. Keep the idea over there, off to the side in your mind, while a rich, enjoyable, positive experience is right here, under the spotlight on the stage of awareness. Feel it. Next, if you feel comfortable doing so, you could have a felt sense of the negative, such as some loss and mourning from losing a parent. Remember to keep this material smaller, dimmer, and less active than what's positive in awareness. If the negative starts to draw you in, refocus on the positive. Go into it. Last, you could imagine or sense that the positive is contacting and penetrating the negative material. This is the most intense way to engage it. Consequently, it may be the most effective, but it is also the riskiest. So be careful and pull attention away from the negative if it's too much for you. There could be an image of the positive experience sinking into hollows inside and gradually filling them up, or easing bruised, wounded places like a soothing balm. A useful perspective could replace limiting or painful beliefs. More adult parts of you could comfort, reassure, and cherish younger parts. Compassion could touch suffering. When you do linking, be resourceful and creative. Stay on your own side, helping whatever is beneficial to prevail in your mind. Use your imagination and go with your intuition. For example, one time when I was doing linking, An image came to me of waves of love lapping on the shore of my mind with a rising tide. Experiential practice, a process of linking. Here is an extended experiential process that you can use to address painful or harmful thoughts, sensations, emotions, or desires, what I will be calling the negative material. Going into this process, know what the positive material is, the beneficial experiences, the inner strengths, the vitamin C that you'd like to associate to the negative material. Remember to drop the negative if it becomes too big or overwhelming. Stay on your own side and adapt this practice to your needs. It will probably take at least a few minutes, and you can spend as much time with it as you like. So let's begin. 1. Have. Call up a sense of being on your own side. Then begin creating an experience of the positive material. You could remember when you really experienced it, perhaps a time you felt particularly safe, satisfied, or connected. Or imagine being in the kind of setting or relationship that would naturally evoke this resource experience. Or access this experience directly, dropping into the sense memory of it in your body. Or use any other way that works for you to have a clear experience of this positive material. 2. Enrich. Stay with the positive material. If your mind wanders, come back to it. Help it to become more intense, filling your awareness. Explore this experience, sensing it in your body, opening to its emotional aspects. Recognize how it is relevant, important, and valuable for you. 3. Absorb. Intend and sense that this experience is sinking into you, sifting down into you, becoming a part of you. Receive it into yourself, like a gentle warmth spreading inside. Recognize what feels good about it, what seems wholesome and enjoyable. 4. Link. When you're ready, be aware of the idea of the negative material off to the side, and the positive material large and rich in the foreground of your awareness. It's fine if your attention moves quickly back and forth between the positive and the negative, but generally see if you can be aware of both of them at the same time. Stay with the idea of the negative alongside the positive experience for a few breaths or longer. Then, as long as it's not overwhelming, you could have more of a felt sense of the negative, but still off to the side, smaller and less powerful than the positive. Again, explore what this is like for a few breaths or more, resting in the positive, taking refuge in a strong sense of the positive, while there is also a feeling of the negative in the background of awareness. Finally, if it seems right, imagine that the positive is touching and going into the negative. Perhaps like waves spreading out into sore or empty places inside. Or reassurance and comfort and kindness soothing sad and hurt parts of you. Or the light of insight spreading into shadows. Or adult compassion and love holding and perhaps murmuring softly to young, hurting parts. there could be a sense of the positive being received into the negative, slipping into it and under it, perhaps gently dislodging it, releasing it from your mind. Try not to intellectualize about the negative or get into a big story about it. Keep this as experiential as possible. If the negative becomes too big or you get lost in it, drop it and focus only on the positive material. Once you are reestablished in the positive, you can become aware of the negative again if you like. Finishing up this experiential practice, let go of anything negative and rest in the positive material. Enjoy it. You've earned it. Key points. We acquire mental resources through learning. This happens in two stages, activation and installation. First, there must be an experience of the resource or related factors, and second, that experience must be converted into a lasting change of neural structure and function. Without installation, there is no learning, healing, or development. Getting better at installation will steepen your growth curve, and these skills can be applied to anything you would like to develop inside yourself. This is not about positive thinking. It is about realistic thinking, seeing the whole mosaic of reality with its problems and pains, as well as its many, many reassuring, pleasurable, and useful parts. You can grow inner strengths in four steps, summarized in the acronym HEAL. Have a positive, enjoyable, beneficial experience. Enrich it. Absorb it. And, optionally, link it to negative material. You can use the HEAL steps to grow the mental resources that would help you the most these days. Use the framework of the three basic needs, safety, satisfaction, and connection, to identify the inner strengths that are matched to your challenges. The link step is a powerful way to use positive psychological material to soothe, reduce, and even replace negative material. We can learn how to learn. Learning is the inner strength that grows all the other ones. Part 2, Resourcing. Chapter 4, Grit. Toughness is in the soul and spirit, not in muscles. Alex Karras. Grit is dogged, tough resourcefulness. It's what remains after all else has been ground down. And when even grit is worn away, people are in trouble. I learned some scary lessons about this when I went camping one winter with my friend Bob. We spent the day slogging through deep snow in the backcountry near Sequoia National Park, climbing uphill in our snowshoes. Through previous experiences in wilderness and other intense settings, we had both developed a fair amount of gritty endurance and felt confident that we'd be all right. Bob has tremendous natural vitality, and he powered ahead to break the trail for both of us. As it grew dark and we needed to make camp, we were both exhausted, and Bob began shivering uncontrollably. He had poured out so much energy without refueling himself that he was sliding into hypothermia, the first stage of freezing to death. In effect, he had used up his internal supply of grit, which put his need for safety at mortal risk. The temperature was dropping rapidly, and I was extremely drained myself. We hurried to set up the tent, get into our sleeping bags, light the stove, drink hot water, and eat hot food. Soon Bob's teeth stopped chattering, and after a while he began to feel normal again. After a long, cold night, we broke camp in the morning and made our way slowly back to civilization. This time, much more careful about not using up everything inside ourselves. This was a dramatic lesson in the importance of developing grit in the first place for the challenges you know about and the ones waiting around the corner to surprise you. If Bob and I had not acquired deep reserves through our experiences and training, something very serious could have happened. Second, it was a sobering reminder of the importance of refueling grit along the way and not letting the needle hit empty. Grit is based on several things. To increase and refuel the grit inside you, we'll start by exploring agency, the sense that you can make things happen rather than being helpless. Then I'll cover different aspects of determination, including patience and a fierce tenacity. We'll finish with ways to increase your vitality, including through accepting and appreciating your body. For additional perspectives on grit, I recommend Angela Duckworth's book with this title and her related research. Agency. Agency is the sense of being a cause rather than an effect. Agency is present if you deliberately pick a blue sweater over a red one, or listen to someone express an opinion and think, "Nah, I don't agree with that." With agency, you are active rather than passive, taking initiative and directing your life rather than being swept along. Agency is central to grit, since without it, a person can't mobilize other internal resources for coping. If you've been knocked down by life, agency is the first thing you draw on to get up off the floor. Unlearning helplessness. Agency is the opposite of helplessness. Research by Martin Seligman and others has shown that we are very susceptible to acquiring learned helplessness through experiences of powerlessness, immobilization, and defeat. Consider a child who can't escape bullying, or an adult who's been assaulted, or situations in which there is a mismatch between responsibility and resources, such as one person in a downsized corporation trying to do the jobs of three people. Even subtle forms of powerlessness wear people down over time, such as repeatedly trying to get the sustained empathic attention of a partner and finally giving up. A growing sense of pessimism and hopelessness drags down mood, coping, and ambition, and is a major risk factor for depression. It typically takes many experiences of agency to compensate for a single experience of helplessness, another example of the brain's negativity bias. To prevent helplessness in the first place, or to gradually unlearn it, look for experiences in which you are making a choice or influencing an outcome. Then, focus on and take into yourself the sense of being an active agent, a hammer rather than a nail. In particular, look for experiences in which there is a vigorous sense of making something happen or pushing something forward. It could be deciding to go for one last repetition of lifting a weight at the gym or holding a yoga pose 10 seconds longer. In an interaction, you could decide you've had enough and it's time to exit. In a meeting, if your idea has been misunderstood and brushed aside, you could stick your hand up and make your point again. In life, there are times when we step back and take a hard look at something, such as a relationship, living situation, or way of parenting, and, in a deep and honest way, recognize that we need to make a significant change. It could be hard, it could be painful, but we choose the change. This also is agency. When agency is limited. When your options are very limited, look for the little things you can do and focus on the feeling of agency regarding them. For example, if you're facing a health crisis, could you decide to go online and learn more about it? In an argument with a family member, can you feel like you are deciding what to say and what not to say? The more powerful the forces bearing down on a person, the more important it is to find ways to experience some sense, any sense, of agency. If we can't exercise agency out there with words or deeds, we can usually make choices in here, inside the mind. Unless something is extraordinarily painful, physically or emotionally, we have the power to shift attention away from it to something more enjoyable or useful. For example, when I sit in my dentist chair, I'll deliberately remember walking through high alpine meadows in Yosemite National Park. We also have power over how we think about situations and relationships, such as putting them in perspective. The less power we have out there, the more important it is to exercise agency in here. When you make deliberate choices inside your mind, try to recognize that fact and register the feeling of being the chooser. Many things happen to a person. Still, we can experience a sense of agency in how we respond to them. If this is possible in even the most terrible, most horrific situations of all, then it is possible in everyday life. Consider this passage from Viktor Frankl after surviving the Holocaust. Quote, "We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." Unquote. Tend to the causes. It makes sense to focus on where we do have agency instead of where we do not. For example, there's an old apple tree in our backyard that I've pruned and watered over the years, but I've never been able to make it give me an apple. In much the same way, there are so many things in life for which all we can do is tend to the causes, but we cannot force the results. We can nurture and guide our children, but we can't control what they end up doing as adults. We can be decent and loving toward other people, but we can't make them love us. We can eat nourishing food, exercise, and go to the doctor, but we may get sick anyway. All we can do is water the fruit tree. We may not be able to directly create something we want, but we can still encourage the underlying processes that will bring it into being. Knowing this brings a sense of both responsibility and peace. In terms of responsibility, it's on each of us to tend to the causes that we can influence, to use the agency that we do have. Take some time to consider major areas of your life, such as health and relationships, and look for simple, realistic things you could do that would cause them to improve. For example, it might make a real difference to have a solid breakfast, stand up from your desk at least once an hour, and get to sleep at a reasonable time most nights. Slowing down and just listening to a friend can help a relationship. Seemingly little things often cause big results. As you consider your life in this way, if you see something that calls for more tending, let that seeing become a feeling of commitment that you enrich and absorb, giving over to it so it moves you to action. At the end of each day, know deep down that you did the best you could. Meanwhile, enjoy a greater sense of peace. Many of us go through life insisting, metaphorically speaking, that seeds give us apples. But then we lock on to particular results and get frustrated and self-critical if they don't happen. The truth is, 10,000 causes upstream of this moment are bringing it into being, and most of them are beyond anyone's control. Recognizing this fact and accepting it may feel initially alarming, like being swept down along a river. But as you get used to it, you could feel an easing of tension and drivenness and a growing serenity. Determination. Challenging things happen to every person, and determination is the steadfast fortitude we draw on to endure, cope with, and survive them. A person can be wounded, frail, and very determined. In fact, some of the most determined people I've known were the most burdened, such as a young Haitian friend working his way out of terrible poverty, and another friend who is dealing with gradually losing his vision. Determination might sound grim, but in fact, it can be playful and lighthearted. Consider this description I once heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, the peace advocate, monk, and Buddhist teacher. Quote, "A cloud, a butterfly, and a bulldozer." Unquote. Determination has four aspects to it: resolve, patience, persistence, and fierceness. As you go through your day, you can use the heel steps to turn experiences of these aspects into an even stronger sense of determination inside yourself. Resolve. Resolve is aimed towards a goal. Otherwise, it's like having a car with a big engine but no destination. To get an embodied sense of what resolve feels like, think about times when you've been serious about a goal. What's the look on your face when you are absolutely committed to something? When you mean business, there could be a gravity about you, a quality of steely intent, When you have an experience of resolve, stay with it for a dozen seconds or longer to help yourself become even more resolute and determined. Of course, we need to be adaptable in pursuit of our goals. I can get too finicky about little details and lose sight of the end in my fixation on means. True resolve is like sailing a boat, tacking back and forth into the wind, zigging and zagging to get to your destination. Along the way, have heart. Otherwise, resolve can become cold and top-down, like a harsh inner boss yelling at you, rather than warm and bottom-up. Resolve includes passion, fieriness, and even joy. Think of something you quote-unquote should do, but don't stick with, and take some time to imagine doing it in a more wholehearted way. As you imagine this, notice that your sense of commitment naturally increases. Let this greater sense of resolve sink in. Patience. One time as a teenager, I had one of those haunting experiences that sticks with you. Looking down from our apartment late at night, I saw a workman trudging steadily along the sidewalk. I didn't know if he was headed home or about to start another shift. Either way, he looked tired. Maybe his feet hurt, maybe he wished he had a different life, but he kept on going. He made me think of my parents and other people who kept on doing the right thing, fulfilling their obligations, patiently putting one foot in front of the other. Many of the mistakes in my life have come from being impatient, annoyed with how long something was taking, pressuring others to hurry up, or jumping to a conclusion. Patience doesn't mean ignoring real problems, but life is full of delays and discomfort, and sometimes we just have to wait. Patience might sound like a modest virtue, but it's the essence of two primary factors in mental health and worldly success. The first is delay of gratification, the willingness to put off immediate rewards for the sake of a greater future reward. The second is distress tolerance, the capacity to endure a painful experience without making the bad thing worse, such as self-medicating with overeating or alcohol. Pick some part of your life that's frustrating or exasperating and see if you can imagine being more patient about it. What would it feel like to be more patient? There could be a sense of accepting things as they are, burying your stress or pain, one breath after another, one step after another. What, inside yourself, could help you be more patient? You could focus on the feeling that you are still alive, still basically okay, even when you're not getting what you want. You could deliberately let go of irritation, and you could remember that whatever you're putting up with is likely a brief period in the larger span of your life. If you were more patient, what would be some of the good results? You would probably feel better and be more effective, and others might be happier with you. When you experience patience, use the absorb step and heal to receive it into yourself with a sense of actually becoming more patient. Try the link step to hold both patience and frustration in your awareness and to use patience to ease and calm any tense or irritated places inside. Persistence. Different versions of this fable appear in many cultures. Once upon a time, some frogs fell into a bucket full of cream. The sides were steep, none of the frogs could escape, and one by one they gave up and drowned. But one frog kept swimming, working its little legs methodically to stay afloat. And slowly, ever so slowly, it churned the cream into solid butter. Then the frog hopped out of the bucket and lived happily ever after. I love this fable and the idea that, no matter what, you can still persist on your own behalf, if only inside your mind. Even if your efforts don't pay off, you'll know in your heart that you tried, and that in itself feels honorable and comforting. It's usually the small, undramatic, sustained efforts over time that make the most difference. Imagine that you want to push a large boat at a dock out into the water. You could run full speed and smash into the boat, but that would be painful and have little effect. Or you could stand on the end of the dock, lean against the boat, and keep on leaning. Is there something important in your life that would be good to keep leaning into? Perhaps regular exercise, meditation, or gradually mending a relationship with a spouse or a teenager, one brief positive interaction at a time. You can accomplish big things by persisting with small actions. Suppose you thought about writing a book, but it seems overwhelming. Well, could you write 2 pages over the course of a day? Do this every few days, 100 times spread out over a year, and you've got a book. Sometimes the most important things to persist with are your thoughts and feelings. I've known people who pushed bravely ahead through tough external conditions, such as hazardous jobs, but gave up when it was important to be emotionally vulnerable. Here, too, small steps move a person forward. Try staying with a scary feeling 1 breath longer than usual, or being a bit more revealed to another person. Notice the results. Most likely nothing bad will happen, and in fact it will feel good and others will be fine. Then register and internalize the sense of taking a small risk and it turning out well. Build on this to take the next step, and on and on. Fierceness. Determination taps into something ancient and wild inside each one of us. I had a startling experience of this when I was 19, helping to take a group of school children on a backpacking trip through the Yosemite High Country. It was late spring, and the nights were still very cold. We made a lunch stop in a large, jumbled boulder field near a river, then kept going. A mile or so later, one of the kids realized he'd left his jacket back where we'd stopped. I said I'd go get it, and then meet up at the campsite for dinner. I set down my pack, hiked back to the boulder field, searched through it, and found the jacket. But I couldn't relocate the trail. I cast about in all directions, surrounded by rocks, trees, and broken ground. The nearest person could have been miles away. I was lost, wearing just a t-shirt, no water, no food, and night coming on. I started to panic. Then a strange feeling came over me that I would do whatever it took to survive. There was a feral intensity, not cruel or evil, but like a hungry hawk swooping down upon a rabbit, not mean or vengeful, but fiercely committed to its own life. The intensity burned away the panic, and it energized me to search carefully for the faint traces of the trail. I eventually found it, and many miles later rejoined my friends late that night. The sense of that fierce will to endure has stayed with me, and I've drawn on it many times. Paradoxically, just knowing that I can go there if need be has helped me turn the other cheek in certain situations, in effect, using something feral to stay civilized. We are animals, strong and tenacious enough to rise to the top of the food chain. In some approaches to psychology, religion, and child-rearing, you'll find an underlying idea that the primal basement in everyone's mind is full of smelly, nasty creatures that must be locked away. Sure, we need to regulate ourselves, but we don't need to fear and shame the wild things inside. Think of a good experience you've had of being fierce and strong, perhaps while standing up for someone, moving through wilderness, or handling an emergency. Imagine what it would feel like and how it might help to bring some of that determined intensity into a challenging situation today. Looking back, I've often been too tame, too buttoned up. Perhaps you, like me, could benefit from opening a door inside and drawing on something that's fiercely helpful. Vitality. What we think and feel is grounded in physical sensations and movements. For example, psychologists have found that the cognitive development of children is shaped by sensory motor activity, and that the perspectives and moods of adults are highly influenced by pleasure and pain, energy and fatigue, and health and illness. In similar ways, we're affected by how we feel about our bodies and treat them. I spent years thinking that my body was too skinny, too fat, too this, too that, while working it hard, like spurring a horse uphill day after day. If a person doesn't like his or her body, it's harder to take good care of it. Then vitality declines, and with it, grit and resilience. We need to accept, appreciate, and nurture the body and treat it more like a friend than a disposable beast. Accepting your body. How do you feel about your body? Many people are self-critical, embarrassed, or ashamed about their bodies. One reason for this is that we are bombarded with countless messages from early childhood onward about how girls and boys, women and men, and people in general are supposed to look. Think about what you have heard and seen over the years from your parents, classmates, and friends, and from advertising and media. Few can actually meet these standards, but we internalize them anyway, looking in the mirror and judging and pressuring and shaming ourselves. Then it's all too easy to obsess about food or exercise, go through yo-yo dieting, and perhaps even develop an eating disorder. To have more acceptance of your body, start by bringing to mind some people you like and respect. How much does the way they look matter to you? Probably very little. Also think about meeting new people. How long does it take to get past how they look to a deeper sense of them? Probably less than a minute. We worry about what others are thinking about how we look, but usually they are thinking about it about as much as we are thinking about their appearance. Not much at all. What does it feel like to know that how you look is not important to most people? What does it feel like to know that, in fact, how you look is just fine to them? Take some time with this and help this knowing establish itself in you. If your attention is drawn to that one put down about your weight, pull it back to what you know about how most people see you. Help a sense of conviction develop, the feeling that you truly believe that others accept how you look. Perhaps say to yourself things like, "Others are busy and have their own concerns. They are not spending time criticizing my appearance. Even if one person is judgmental, others are accepting. They feel fine about me." Open to related feelings of relief and reassurance. Relax and let the good news sink into you. Then take the next step and see if you can be as accepting of your body as others are. It's fine to have realistic goals about fitness and health. Meanwhile, your body is what it is, and you can accept it. Pick a part of your body that you like, such as your fingers or eyes. Accept this part of your body and take in the sense of accepting it. Then, starting with your feet, systematically try to accept each major part of your body. You can look at yourself directly, use a mirror, or bring to mind different parts. Do what helps you move into acceptance. If you can't accept a part of your body, move on to other parts. Say to yourself things like, "Left foot, I accept you. Right foot, you are acceptable to me. Left lower leg, I can accept you as you are. Right lower leg, accepting you too." Let the sense of acceptance grow and spread in your mind. Relax and let go of judgments. You could use the link step to use that acceptance to calm and ease any self-criticism about your body. Appreciating your body. Besides accepting your body, can you appreciate it? Suppose you had a friend with a body like yours, as well as the talents, skills, good heart, and other virtues that you have. Also suppose that this friend is preoccupied, self-conscious, or self-critical about his or her body in whatever ways you are yourself. Imagine some of the reasonable, compassionate, and encouraging things you might say to this friend. You could write these down if you want. Then say them to yourself inside your mind, or even out loud. And also try this experiential practice. Experiential practice. Body, thank you. As with any practice, adapt this to your needs. Take good care of yourself and disengage from anything that is too uncomfortable. Take a few breaths, relax, and get a sense of being on your own side. Bring to mind others who appreciate, like, or love you, and open to feeling cared about. Imagine your life as a kind of movie, starting when you were very young and moving forward to the present. Watching this movie, see some of the ways that your body has protected and served you. Even if it has had limitations, disabilities, or illnesses, It is still taking care of you in so many ways. Imagine your body saying how it has helped you, such as,